Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 5th of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we are delighted to be joined today by Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, and also Mark Anderson from American Free Press. And of course, Mark also runs the Truth Hound blogspot. Well, major events, Mike.
Let's start straight away with London Bridge attacks. Patrick, 21st Century Wire here, pretty quick to get some comment on this. This was Sean Helton. London Bridge attacks, who knew, who benefits the most? What was Sean's main points here? We're going to go into this in a bit of detail, but what was he highlighting?
Sean was highlighting a few things, one of them looking at how this event helped to shape the environment for the upcoming general election, which is scheduled for this week. So that was one point that he made. He also pointed out that there was a unusual event at London Bridge on March 7th, where there was an abandoned car that was identified by police, and the whole area was evacuated for this, and dozens of security service personnel and vehicles descended on the area, and the area was evacuated. So he said that this could have been somewhat of a dry run, if you will, for an emergency event. And so a number of other items in here, and who benefits the most, immediate reaction from the state to call on, say, controls on the internet, increased security, less privacy. This is all been put in print here in advance. So we've basically said that this is the agenda for the London Bridge attack. So who benefits really in terms of consolidation of power of the state? And then soon we might expect calls for increased military operations in Syria to sort of do something to fight ISIS, as it were. And it's already being pressure being put now by Washington, by President Trump. The rhetoric is very intense right now, the last 24 hours. From Washington, really almost berating the UK for not doing enough to stop radical Islam. And so Trump's using this to bolster his travel ban talking point, which has been really going since the beginning, since the inauguration. So you can kind of see the configuration of events here is coming together.
Here we've got the Daily Mail and their coverage of what's been going on. Jihadi was euphoric hours before the attack as he asked a neighbour about hiring a van. Arsenal, supporting father of two, had worked for London Transport, also tried to radicalise children in a local park. And they say that the police shot dead the terrorists, one of whom was wearing an Arsenal shirt within 8 minutes of the initial call. So really what the press here, Patrick, seems to be doing is reinforcing the idea that that the terrorists are living as our neighbours, living amongst us, as it were. But there was something particularly fascinating about this this Mail article, because as we scroll down, they highlight this, and it's an image, and the image is captioned "An Islamic flag unfurled in the middle of a park in broad daylight during the filming of the Channel 4 documentary last year." So once again, Patrick, we seem to have a known wolf.
Yes, and in Sean Helton's first article on London Bridge attacks, he predicted that one of the attackers would in fact be a known wolf. You can go read that in the original post, which was posted hours after London Bridge, and Sean was absolutely correct. Now we find out there was a so-called known wolf known to the security services. Not only that, a celebrity jihadist. So Channel 4 did a documentary last year in 2016. It was released. It was called The Jihadist Next Door. And in this film, and they can't release the names for whatever reason, but this is, I guess, someone, one of the attackers or an accomplice of the attackers, which was featured in this Channel 4 documentary film. And rightly, we point out in the article that, you know, how did Channel 4 get access to this radical cell? Were they working with a stringer? Were they working with a police informant? Were they working with the police themselves to help cast, to get the actors for this documentary together? So this is a valid question I would probably put to Channel 4. So, you know, I'm not saying boasting that Sean was correct in this prediction, but it's the same exact prediction we made on the last four major terrorist attacks, and they've all featured a known wolf. So we're just saying that there's a trend here that's very visible. These are known people, known to the security services, just like the Charlie Hebdo attack as well. Very similar profile MO there, and other similar events in Europe too. So there's a disturbing pattern that's emerging here, and I wish someone in the mainstream media would actually take this to task and investigate it. Maybe one of these newspapers with hundreds of millions of dollars in operating budgets, they could somehow release some resources to investigate this very important trend, which seems to be featured in every single one of these high-profile terror attacks.
As you say, Pat, this is quite remarkable that we've got billions of pounds going into British security services in order for them to spy on everybody at every level of society, supposedly to protect us. And then what we keep hearing is that, well, we knew about this person, we knew about this man, we knew what they were doing, we were warned by their family, and no action taken. So there's something wrong here, isn't there? If all this money is going into Britain's security services, into GCHQ, MI6, MI5, special branch, whatever it is, SO13, and then they continually are effectively apologising, well, we knew, but we couldn't actually do anything. This, to my mind, requires Parliament recalled. This requires the security services to be brought in and questioned as to why they've become so incompetent that they're even told who the terrorists are, but they can't prevent the terror attacks.
It's not just the funding aspect, Brian. It's also the legislative aspect. A number of draconian pieces of legislation have come through, even after the Snoopers Charter, the Investigatory Powers Act, which was put into place only a few months ago, that was basically giving carte blanche blanket surveillance by the security services on citizens. And so based on this, you would think that this was all to stop terrorism. But what have we seen since this draconian piece of legislation has been put in? We've just seen terror attack after terror attack in Britain. So there's a lot of people in the wake of Westminster and Manchester that were on Twitter, you know, media pundits saying the government needs to do something. Our politicians need to do something. What do we elect them to do? To pass laws? They've been passing laws, and the laws have only resulted in more terrorist attacks. So clearly there's a breakdown in the system here and logic. This idea that passing draconian laws is going to stop terror, or reducing people's rights is going to stop terror, it actually doesn't play out in reality.
Okay, well, let's remind ourselves what Theresa May had to say about this. She said the terrorists were confronted and shot by officers within 8 minutes of the police receiving the first emergency call. She said this is, as we all know, the third terrorist attack Britain has experienced within the last 3 months. In March, a similar attack took place just around the corner in Westminster Bridge. She talks about Manchester as well. And at the same time, the security and intelligence agencies and police have disrupted five credible plots since the Westminster attack in March, apparently. Do you believe that?
No, I don't believe it at all. We've heard this before, Mike. They're constantly saying that X number of attacks have been foiled, but we never see any evidence whatsoever that there was going to be an attack, nor that it's somehow been foiled.
Okay. She went on to say, and at the same time, the security and intelligence agencies, so I've just said that, disrupted five attacks. We need to do everything that we can at home to reduce the risks of extremism online. This is quite interesting. She said, we cannot allow this ideology the safe space it needs to breed. Yet that's precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide. We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace and prevent the spread of extremism and terrorism planning. So that's what she's saying, regulation of the internet. Well, what did Tim Farron have to say about that?
Well, I just found this fascinating. Mike, here he is in The Guardian. He's written a piece in The Guardian. He said, Theresa May's pledge to curb radical jihadis by regulating the internet is a risk to freedom and civil liberties. Now, to me, this is the baited hook, because many people picking up on this. So here's Tim Farron coming in. And what he seems to be saying is we need to watch out for our freedoms and civil liberties. But actually, that's not what he's saying, because if you get into what he says, he criticises Theresa May. She can't be trusted to get it right on counter-terrorism policy. And then in comes this bit. The Prime Minister has a record of poor decisions and did the police a huge disservice when she prioritised ineffective mass surveillance over local intelligence gathering. See, I should be able to highlight that. There we go. So when we really think about this, this man's saying, no, 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 we don't want a generalised mass surveillance over the internet. What we really need is to get the spying on people down to local level. This is the PREVENT strategy. This is MAPA, the multi-agency public protection arrangement, where individuals, the police, local mental health, education, hospitals, those people can meet behind closed doors, and any whisper or hearsay, they can then start to build a report on an individual. That individual has no idea they're under surveillance, not only by the state, but by local authorities and local individuals. So what seems to me that what Farron is proposing here is actually even worse than Theresa May come in with.
Now, you mentioned PREVENT, and there's quite a lot in the media about PREVENT over the weekend and today. Some people questioning PREVENT and its effectiveness and suggesting that it should be scrapped. Government's opinion seems to be, no, anybody that says that is delusional.
Well, Mike, we've had a member of the Metropolitan Police speak to us saying that, in their opinion, PREVENT was actually radicalising young children. The PREVENT teams were going into schools, talking to very young pupils and putting the ideas of radical thought into their heads. We've also had reports of, quote, billions of pounds worth of money spent on the PREVENT strategy, for which there were no paper documents as to what people, the police, were actually doing out on the streets. So I think we're getting an increasingly dangerous situation. We haven't got a normal government in place at the moment. We've got Theresa May and a group of other individuals in this famous snake cobra meeting. We don't know who these people are. We are not seeing the minutes of the meeting. And they're now deciding that we're going to have armed police not only on the streets, but having cowboy fights when there's an incident. And I'm going to come on to that subject in just a minute.
Well, Tim Farron's saying that we've got to have intelligence gathering at a local level, but of course, Theresa May and others are suggesting that there are, 30,000 people that need to be spied on, so that might be a little difficult. But let's just remember, she's talking about mass surveillance. Let's remember where this came from originally, and thanks to Patrick for pointing me at this, because this is from 2015. In the Telegraph, ex-MI6 chief John Sawyers, "We cannot stop terrorism unless we spy on innocent people." He was giving a public speech since he gave up his job with MI6. "There's a dilemma because the general public," he said, "politicians and technology companies to some extent want us to be able to monitor the activities of terrorists and other evildoers, but they don't want their own activities to be open to any such monitoring. The benefits of the 18 months debate is that people now understand that it's not possible and there has to be some form of ability to cover communications that are made through modern technology." And he said, "If you allow areas which are completely impenetrable, then you might feel comfortable that your communications are private and no one else can see them. But so are those of people who are trying to do you down and undermine your society."
So we need more spying on innocent people so we can fail to do our job even more efficiently. Is that the way it works?
Well, it seems to be. And of course, as we've already pointed out, it seems that these people are known to them in the first place. So I'm not sure how they can have it both ways.
No.
But
the interject before we go, David Cameron, also in his famous speech I think it was at the UN a few years ago. He said, you know, don't think that in terms of extremists online, you know, don't think that just because you obey the law that you will be safe from the state, you know, watching you or dealing with you, as it were. So again, we can add David Cameron into this lineage of this talking point. This has been groomed over a couple of years now. Theresa May is just the latest oracle in this agenda.
That's absolutely right. So let's come back onto what she said outside Downing Street. She said, while we need to deprive the extremists of safe spaces online, we must not forget that safe spaces that continue to exist in the real world. Yes, that means taking military action to destroy ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So there you go, Patrick, you're bang on the money. And she said, this was the end of her speech outside Downing Street. And I thought it was mentioned it on the Sunday Wire program last night, Patrick. I thought it was particularly interesting. As a mark of respect, the two political parties have suspended our national campaigns for today. That's yesterday, obviously. As a mark of respect, the two political parties, Brian, there are no other political parties.
Not as far as she's concerned, no.
So it seems. But violence can never be allowed to disrupt the democratic process. So because violence can't be allowed to disrupt the democratic process, they're going to disrupt the democratic process.
I think we're seeing chaos coming. These people don't know what they're doing. They're getting they're stumbling over each other. Patrick, I think you wanted back in.
That's classic doublespeak, that quote. If you put that back up on screen real quick, or newspeak or doublespeak, I'm not sure. Maybe Mark Anderson can explain the difference between newspeak and doublespeak, but it's one of those two, Mark. She's contradicting herself right in the same sentence, basically. It's incredible.
Mark, have you any thoughts on what we're doing?
Indeed, it is. Yes. I'm not hearing you guys right now.
Go for it.
Lost a little sound. I'm sorry. There's the double speak and new speak that you're referring to, but also it's in the larger sense that, once again, ISIS is a proxy army for the West. All the evidence points to that, with American and UK and Israeli connivance to sponsor ISIS. And then they drive the innocent peoples of North Africa and the Middle East into Europe. And that helps create the ground troops, if you will, for this ISIS threat in the UK. Mm-hmm. So you have contradictory policies as well as contradictory statements. This is the part that is just blunt reality that people don't want to face. ISIS is a creation of Western intelligence, or at the very least, they've been nurtured along at key points. So the duplicity here and the contradictions just stack up to the heavens. It's really disturbing.
Okay. Well, look, let's just comment on the police here, because I don't know whether people picked up on it, but in the headline that Mike had on screen a bit earlier to do with the jihadis, that was the Daily Mail headline. It did actually mention what the police were up to. So this is a report that I've actually taken off Russia Today, but the quote is Mark Rowley's quote. He says, our initial assessment is in the region of 50 rounds, in the region of 50 bullets were fired by those eight officers. The three attackers were shot dead.
Sorry, that's eight officers who shot after 8 minutes?
you're there. So we've got the police getting to the scene in 8 minutes. That's pretty good. There's eight officers. And then they've got there, they've travelled, they've got there, they've assessed the situation, and the next minute they are spraying rounds. And I'm going to use that expression deliberately. They were spraying rounds. We shoot, we kill three attackers, so they're not going to talk. There's going to be no intelligence coming out of those people anymore. But the other thing that the headline mentioned was that somebody was shot in the head. Well, this is what Mr. Rowley went on to say. As the officers confronted the terrorists and the terrorists were shot, a member of the public also suffered gunshot wounds. Although we do not believe the injuries were critical in nature, they're in hospital receiving medical attention. We will, of course, keep you updated on that. Well, the Daily Mail said that the member of the public was caught in the crossfire and shot in the head. And this is the reality now of having these police on the streets. I was away last week, but in one particular service station, in came the patrol car. Two policemen got out, both carrying sidearms, but apparently Theresa May has said, well, we're not going to arm all police.
Cressida Dick.
Yeah. Okay, I beg your pardon. And of course, we've also seen close at hand around the UK Column studio, armed police, automatic weapons training. Are these men totally under control? I don't believe so. We've now had the first civilian casualty, but are they working a shoot to kill policy?
I believe they are, but let's bring Cressida Dick on screen. She was giving a presentation yesterday and she's given more interviews today. She's saying we're clearly going to have to look at our resource levels and how we use them, but that's just a natural thing to do, that she believes the Metropolitan Police is well resourced. It's interesting that, you know, how are they resourcing the police? Clearly, Theresa May coming under a lot of criticism at the moment because she has systematically under-resourced the police. But in all the discussions I've seen about how they're going to resource the police in future, it's not about bobbies on the beat, as it were. It's about some of these more interesting spying activities. This is the kind of direction they want to put the resources into.
Yeah, where the police are acting as a Stasi, which is to spy on people. Isn't it remarkable? We've got common purpose guru Cressida Dick here, who has no experience of leading a force on the scale of the Met Police. And of course, she was in charge of the de Menendez killing, which was another disaster.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's only a few days, in fact, since the Met has launched their new detective recruitment campaign. They are now no longer requiring new recruits to go through the ranks, as it were. They can go straight into become a detective. They're saying, this is Detective Chief Superintendent Stephen Clayman saying, London continues to change and so do its criminals. And of course, he was saying this before the London Bridge attack. Complex crimes such as cyber criminality and the pressing need to protect vulnerable people mean our investigators need to develop new expertise. And he said that budding Sherlock Holmes types who want to get involved, they need a great eye for detail. They need to be able to manage lots of information. They need to be good logical decision makers and critical thinkers. And so they're going to recruit up to 600 new detective vacancies. And the starting salary apparently is £30,000. But they don't need to have been a police constable first.
So that's a recipe for disaster. Well, I just thought we'd bring in the new face of the police. I couldn't resist this. A Guardian photograph. This is the start of the raids, as it says. Fresh raids in East London, as first victim named. I just looked at these two. Presumably, these are both police officers. I don't know. I look at the faces of these women. I do not get good vibes. Mm. What do I mean about that? I don't get measured professional. I'm not looking in the faces of people with any form of empathy. My personal opinion, I know, but is this now the face of Britain's secret police? I think we're very close to it. But relax, because Theresa May has got a cunning plan to counter extremism. If you're standing, I think you should sit down, because this is, I think Blackadder would be proud of this cunning plan. Here we go. We're going to be the first country to introduce a commission on countering extremism. That's pretty powerful, Mike, isn't it? We're going to have a group of people who are going to talk about what they might do. But she goes on to say it'll be working with the public sector, but also with civil society and organisations and individuals to promote our pluralistic British values, and also to help people identify extremism and to know how to deal with that extremism. So we're going to have a think tank, because at the moment we've thought, but we don't really know what we're going to do except spy on people.
But Patrick, this looks a bit more like gangs and counter-gangs sort of thing, because of course we're driving the, but the British government is driving the extremism. So now we're going to create a commission on countering the extremism, and now we can drive both sides of the argument.
Yeah, they've been nurturing, in order to I'd say for many years now, especially since 9/11. So this government and the U.S. government and some European countries, NATO member states essentially, have been nurturing certain types of extremists or certain devotees to certain political Islamic organizations, let's say, especially those based in Qatar and also Saudi Arabia. And so by doing so, they're hoping to, say, recruit an army to fight in Libya, an army that will fight in Syria, an army that could be deployed. This goes all the way back to the army that was recruited to fight in Afghanistan. That was a global recruiting drive. And so after the war is finished, after the fighting's finished, they then house them back in Europe and they give them everything, benefits, anything you can wish for, and maybe even political clout and some sort of political organizations, and put them in think tanks. Maybe you see them on the BBC, some of these people. Okay. And then also some of them are hanging out in mosques. In other words, you know, it's a very dangerous sort of thing you're cultivating. And then if there is anything that happens, then it's all written off to sort of blowback of foreign policy, or that, the police are being politically correct by protecting Islamic extremists in Britain. That's just a surface level talking point that's being used by certain people in the so-called alt-right and certain parts of the media to whip up righteous indignation, but they're not going very deep. They stop at the sort of PC liberal versus conservative, right versus left juncture, and they don't go further to say the state itself is actually playing both sides of this equation. And so a lot of this has to do with geopolitics and foreign policy, but even goes back further than that. We spoke about it on the show yesterday with Reverend Andrew Ashdown. This goes back to the British Empire. This goes back to colonialism. So a lot of these connections are cultivated post-colonial British Empire. And this was, we need to have this honest, deep discussion about that incorporates history, incorporates geopolitics, incorporates present day geopolitics and foreign policy, incorporates religion as well, incorporates integration and looking at society as a whole. This conversation needs to happen in an honest fashion. The media is not doing it, definitely not. They're just treating it on the surface. And so we're going to continue to have these problems and continue to see maybe some agencies, intelligence agencies, are playing with fire in trying to keep these sort of individuals or organizations so under their control. Sometimes they're not completely in their control, and sometimes they're being directed to instigate the mayhem, some of the mayhem that you see on the streets of Europe.
Right, Patrick, just very briefly on this one, we wanted to highlight this. We've got a couple of stills here from a video that's appeared on YouTube. It's labelled CNN Fake News. It's on the channel of Libertatem, which is Libertatem. And if you search for CNN Stages Fake Muslim Protest at London Bridge Terrorist Attack Scene. And what we seem to have here is CNN with a huge amount of equipment, Patrick, sort of lining up a line of Muslim women with some placards. The presenter then goes on to make a presentation to the camera about this. But they've spent the last 5 minutes organizing these people. So this wasn't a spontaneous protest at all. This is labeled fake news. That's exactly what it is. And it's pretty high budget fake news at that.
Yeah. And you know, when I first saw this video, it's obviously listed all over the Internet as CNN fake news. I believe I recognize this presenter from CNN. But also I thought I saw this same footage on the BBC as well. Or maybe it's been repurposed for the BBC in a rebroadcast. I'm not sure. But this is using London Bridge as a backdrop. And in this video, you can see them. It's an empty scene. And all of a sudden, they're bringing the actors out and they're putting the flowers down. They're on a small island at a crosswalk. But how they're portraying this on camera, the presenter's saying people are laying flowers on the streets of London. And you know, she herself or her directors, set designers, were directing that on this mobile phone footage that you can see online. It's quite extraordinary. You can see the size of the operation. You have basically standby props people. You've got, looks like, set dressers. You've got people handling the actors, directing them. So they've created, this is an AstroTurf, a fake demonstration. Now, the sentiments that these people might hold, or the slogans on these fake placards, might very well be reflected in Muslim communities around Britain. We're not arguing about that, but what we're saying is the physical scene that you're looking at here has been fabricated, staged by the mainstream media, and then broadcast and put out as if it were real, as if it were a grassroots street demonstration. That just shows the absolute fakery and fraud of the mainstream media. It's right there, right? You can see it, a nice behind the scenes little vignette there that says it all.
Indeed it does. Okay, let's bring Mark Anderson in at this point. Mark, you've spent the last, complete change of subject, you spent the last couple of days in Chantilly in Virginia at the Bilderberg conference. We spoke a little bit about this on the Sunday Wire, Patrick's Sunday Wire program last night. But bring us up to date. Take it, everything's closed, finished, wrapped up at this point.
Yes, it is. It's early here, but I'll be making some calls today and tomorrow to the offices of Senator Tom Cotton and Lindsey Graham, the Arkansas and South Carolina neocon senators, to try and get some statements about why they were at Bilderberg this year and what the reason was, what they contributed, or what they wanted to learn from the Bilderberg Group in its 65th year of meetings, having just wound up yesterday, June 4th, in Chantilly, Virginia, at Westfield's Marriott. We, of course, caught a lot of them leaving at Dulles Airport near Chantilly yesterday. And they weren't the real high-level Bilderberg members, as it turned out, that we saw leaving the airport. A lot of photos will be coming out through American Free Press and other outlets. Video footage is pretty widespread from We Are Change, Luke Radowski, at Press for Truth, Dan Dix out of Canada, and many others, myself included, that are documenting this in photos and videos. And you'll see a lot of that in the coming days. But what's one thing that's interesting, reading the Washington Post every day, on the last day of Bilderberg, I thought for a moment that they broke their silence. But here's the headline: Shadow Network Aided Trump's Rise to Power. However, here comes the drum roll. This was not about Bilderberg. On the very last day of Bilderberg, the shadow network that the Washington Post is talking about is the far right, led by David Horowitz, the godfather of the far right, according to the Post. He's that former 1960s radical that saw the light and became a conservative. And so here the Post devotes probably 4,000 or 5,000 words to a story about a shadow network having an effect on the Trump administration, but it's not Bilderberg at all. It's Stephen K. Bannon. It's David Horowitz. It's the far right. And so here's this meme again, that the only troublemakers in the world are the nationalists, are the far right. And if they get their way, the world is going to splinter up and disintegrate, when in fact it's the internationalist monopoly capitalist ilk, as reflected at Bilderberg, that are really causing the problems here. And that's where the real shadow meeting is that's affecting the Trump administration that had, as I mentioned on the radio, that had no less than 4 officials at Bilderberg this year, which is unprecedented, having had H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, Nadia Shadlow, a War Hawk, War College wonk, also out of the National Security Branch, and then Christopher Liddell, a strategic advisor to Trump. So a lot of misdirection out of the Washington Post using this worn-out far-right theme, and then completely overlooking and completely burying the story of the Bilderberg Group, having met with White House officials and 2 sitting senators. So the misdirection is very blunt here. And at the same time, the far right theme takes everybody's attention away from the internationalists. And that leads right to the guy, right to what you guys are talking about today. And that's the war on terror, and how the war on terror fostered by the internationalists is reducing our freedoms at home, making our home nations into police states and surveillance states, and extending and continuing the internationalist interventionist wars abroad at the same time. So we lose our domestic civil liberties while at the same time being in a constant state of war. So the misdirection by the Bilderberg member Washington Post, which gives money to Bilderberg, creates this confusion and this misdirection to where we don't see the bigger picture that we're trying so hard to bring out today and in other news shows that we do.
So they've left now. Have you had a chance to do what we did in 2013? And is it possible to get into the hotel at this stage and see if there's still any signage up or any hint of what was on the agenda?
It wasn't possible last night. I'm going to look into that today. Typically, they wait at least until the next day, 18 to 24 hours after they take off, at the very least 12 hours after they've left, before they'll open it up again. Certainly, it was not possible last night. Some of them didn't get out of the Chantilly Hotel until 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and at minimum, they needed the rest of Sunday, June 4th, to clean up. But we'll see what happens today here, Monday, June 5th, and see if it's possible. Of course, I'm not optimistic that that'll do a whole lot of good. The main thing I'm keen on is trying to get some sort of statement from the White House and the two senators on what their purpose was at Bilderberg. And Bilderberg, of course, through Nadia Shadlow and many others, is continuing to discuss deep state internationalist networking, going into their Global Cities Forum through the related Chicago group, the Council on Global Affairs. That's coming up June 7th through 9th. So they're continuing with that aspect of their private governance, this World Global Cities thing that's coming up. And in the meantime, there's just a lot to sort out yet in terms of the people that were there and what they're discussing, some of which I discussed yesterday on the 21 Wire Sunday radio show. But it's a lot of work, and it seems like there's never enough hours in the day to do it.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Now, just before we leave this, just give us a little bit more on this Global Cities meeting. Obviously, after Trump abandoned the Paris Climate Agreement, the C40 Cities think tank, which seems to represent quite a number of cities, including a lot in the United States, said, well, it doesn't matter what Trump's doing at a federal level. We're going to implement the Paris Accords at the city level. And we this is increasingly city level governance coming to the fore. So what's this meeting going to be about? And do you know who's going to be attending that just yet?
I'd have to look at the list. A major player in this is the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, Ivel Dalder. He's a former ambassador to NATO for the United States, and he's served in other capacities in the government. He's kind of like what Richard Haass is to the Council on Foreign Relations, Ivel Dalder is to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And he's the major organizer. This is the second major Chicago Global City Summit, and it's taking a place again in this large auditorium in the Chicago Art Institute, right in the Miracle Mile area of Chicago, June 7th through 9th, as I mentioned. And it's interesting what you said, Mike, that the cities like Chicago, which is run by the internationalist mayor, Rahm Emanuel, I think there's always been a purpose to that. Cities like Chicago are saying what you're saying. It's not just that they want to adopt green technologies, which isn't altogether a bad thing. The dependence on crude oil and coal brings a lot of problems, let's face it. And it's not always about climate change, but other concerns. But the thing is that they're saying they're going to implement a climate accord independent of the nation state that the cities inhabit. Now, that's a whole other matter. That suggests, as I mentioned on the radio yesterday, that suggests that the cities networking together under the Global Cities grid want to basically ideologically or in a policy sense secede from their home nation state and go it alone in a kind of bottom-up strategy, while the other aspects of the international establishment work from the top down, a kind of pincer strategy. And that is, words subversive of the nation state that's been the accepted model of governance or government for, centuries now. Although the Wall Street Journal did come out with an article over the weekend, The Case for the Nation State by Sir Roger Scruton, who's from the UK, of course. Not a bad article. The problem with Roger Scruton's article, though, is that he's saying many good things about the nation state, that the nation state is in many ways the best way for mankind to go, along with the family and religion and things that are organically part of the nation state. But then he turns around and says, Sir Roger Scruton, he says that we just need to have globalization in a more soft-edged kind of way.
Yeah.
So globalization is bad, but if you cut off the sharp edges, then globalization is palatable. And maybe some aspects of globalization are inevitable in the technological sense. It's not easy to prevent all of that. But you keep hearing these false arguments, these misleading arguments like that, as this global cities philosophy takes root. And so I'll be reporting about the Chicago group later in the week, and maybe I can get back on the show and give you an update of more details. But Chicago is one of the leading cities in this global grid to try and break away from the nation state and pursue immigration and climate policies on their own. And this is a very dramatic, pivotal thing that needs to be scrutinized ever more closely.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Right, a couple of ads then. Well, before we bring in a couple of ads, I just mentioned that this is obviously the last few days before the election. Ian Crane has decided that he will run an episode of Humanity versus Insanity live at 3 p.m. every afternoon this week. So he will be in shortly to do exactly that. So 3 p.m. On the live stream, you can watch that live. But let's have a couple of ads. Mortgage Compensation Seminar, 8th of June, between 6, starts at 6 p.m. Sim event, cymevents.co.uk to book your place. And that is in Birmingham. And of course, this coming Sunday, Media on Trial, Patrick Henningsen, Vanessa Bealey, Professor Piers Robinson, Robert Stewart, Professor Tim Hayward speaking. So do get along to that. That is in the Cheese and Grain in Froom. Now, running out of time, so we've got to move on quite quickly. Now, this is the 800th day since the war in Yemen began. It's 800 days since the first airstrike in Yemen. 800 days of military campaign on Yemen by Saudi Arabia and its allies. 800 days of United Nations silence and sanctions. 800 days of the US and UK solidarity and support for Saudi as they bomb. And so there is a group has set up a campaign. The hashtag is Stop the War on Yemen. And they're asking for everybody to get involved and to really, over the next 10 days, push the Yemeni issue. Because, Patrick, this continues to be, in a sense, the silent war, the one that the mainstream media just doesn't want to go near. Largely because of Saudi involvement, I guess.
Yeah, largely because of Saudi involvement, but also because what's happened in Syria over the last 6 years has pretty much dominated, and you could say hogged the headlines and the news coverage. And part of that is intentional by the mainstream media. They were piling in on Syria even when the Syrian government was absolutely winning in a lot of areas and doing hashtag campaigns about the Aleppo genocide just before Aleppo is about to be liberated in December. And all of during this time, Yemen is being carpet bombed by Saudi Arabia with U.S. and British bombs and record-breaking arms sales to Saudi Arabia from both the United Kingdom and the United States. So very profitable for the defense contractors. And so meanwhile, this country, Yemen, one of the oldest civilizations, some of the most oldest continuously inhabited structures in the world, a great culture, brilliant people have just been getting hammered, basically. For what? Because the president, the puppet president that's favored by Riyadh and by Washington, D.C. and by London, basically fled. He overstayed his term in office, fled the country, and then basically, so they're bombing on his behalf, basically, President Hadi. So he's not the legitimate leader by anyone's measure of Saudi, and yet they've waged this war for this puppet leader who they say is the legitimate rightful ruler of Yemen. And then they frame the whole conflict in terms of Iran is supporting the rebels in Yemen. This is how they framed it. When in fact there's a pretty broad coalition of people who oppose Saudi Arabia and the war they're waging on Yemen. And it includes not just Shiites, but Sunnis as well, and other tribal elements within the country Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is backing al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and using them as their shock troops on the ground. So we can kind of get a picture of what's going on here, some of the usual actors that we've seen deployed in other places in the Middle East. So it's a fraudulent war. It's against every international law. It is akin to, this is why Nazi Germany was put on the stand at Nuremberg, undeclared wars of aggression. This is why the UN was formed in the first place. And what does the UN do? They put Saudi Arabia in charge of the Human Rights Council. Yeah. So these are the times we're living in right now.
Absolutely. But not all well in the Gulf. And I have to say, credit to 21st Century War, because Stuart Hooper here, one of the first to comment on this at all. Gulf monarchy sacrificed neighbor Qatar as sponsor of terrorism. The hypocrisy here is fantastic, Patrick.
Sure. We actually spoke about this, Mike. We gave the prelude to this last week, I think on Friday, when we featured that article by the Middle East-based journalist Sharmeen Narwani, which was talking about how the sort of Sunni unity that there at the Riyadh summit of the Arab nations, this was supposed to be the formation of an Arab NATO. This was chaired unofficially by Donald Trump. And at this meeting, the Emir of Qatar broke ranks and spoke up against an Arab NATO, which is designed to basically confront Iran in the region. And so he broke ranks, and you can see the U.S. and the U.K. are playing both sides of this spat between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, or Saudi and the Emirates and Qatar. They're playing absolutely both sides of this. Qatar hosts U.S. CENTCOM, Central Command and Control, okay? And so the major military establishment there. The United States fully backs Qatar and fully backs Saudi Arabia. And so now Saudi Arabia and the UAE have broken off diplomatic relations effectively with their neighbor Qatar, who they've also been joined in fighting a proxy war against the Syrian government. So behind both of all these players, you see the U.S. and the U.K. And doing what they do best, which is to play people off against each other for some sort of geopolitical advantage. Okay. And we see Israel in the background, very quiet too. Who are basically preparing some sort of advantage from this split we're seeing right now.
But perhaps Bashar al-Assad gets the prize for telling the truth about who's really funding terrorism here, because he was speaking to India's We on TV yesterday. He said when the Saud family created this kingdom, that's Saudi Arabia, they created it in cooperation and coordination with the Wahhabi institutions. So it's one institution, the Wahhabi institutions, the extremism or extremists in Saudi Arabia defend the state because it's their state, it's their own state, it's one. You cannot talk about terrorism and the Saud family as two entities. I have to be very frank with you, that's why they don't deflect. They export the terrorism or the extremism or the Wahhabi ideology to the rest of the world. Nearly every mosque has been supported financially and ideologically through books and through every other means by the Wahhabi institutions. So he's absolutely placing the blame, and it can't just be placed at the door of Qatar.
No, it can't. So what I think is going on here is that you have to understand, if you jump into a black cab on the streets of London today, that black cabbie is going to tell you that now Saudi Arabia is behind the funding of radical mosques and radical extremism in the UK, in Europe, and around the world. So this talking point has made it down to street level, to Sun readers level. Okay, that means it's everywhere. That means everybody has connected these dots by now. So what Saudi Arabia is trying to do by throwing Qatar under the bus is to shift some of the blame there. Unfortunately, Qatar is not a household name like Saudi Arabia is in the West. So I don't know how much this is going to net. So Qatar tends to favor the Muslim Brotherhood. They house the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood branch of Hamas are based in Qatar. Okay, Saudi Arabia and the UAE don't like the Muslim Brotherhood track because they see that as a potential threat, this politicized version of Islam. So they don't like it. And in fact, they helped to wage a second Arab Spring in June of 2013 to overthrow the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt at the time. A lot of people aren't aware of that. Okay. That's how that went down. So there is a split within extremist schools in the Middle East. They're not all on the same page, but I can guarantee you this, everybody, on both sides, on the Saudi side and on the Qatari side, there's a Union Jack and Old Glory, okay? The United States and Britain are absolutely behind both sides of this spat.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, we just bring in Theresa May just to finish that segment, because very interesting here in The Guardian. We've got Theresa being questioned over the fact she's trying to suppress a report into the funding of jihadi groups, because it actually says, well, of course, one of the countries funding was Saudi. So, as you say, this does seem to be coming to the surface. We're coming towards the end here, just on the clock. But have a look at this. This is the BBC at work against the backdrop of the wars and bloodshed, whether it's Syria or Yemen. I thought this was just utterly incredible. Some stills from a BBC video, which is promoting this model. And why is the BBC interested in this lady? Well, she's gone from supermodel to this. What's the angle? Well, this woman has become a fighter, so the BBC is promoting her. But let's have a look at what this little video actually talks about. Here she is, Hannah Tiger Bowman. She says, it's not a fight against ISIS. ISIS is just an inconvenience. So that rather smashes the BBC's approach that she's out there fighting ISIS. She says, no, I'm not really here fighting ISIS. It's a fight actually for women's rights. That's a pretty amazing statement. The BBC pushing forward a role model of a woman now killing people, could say murder, because presumably the deaths are not within a court. But here she is, killing for women's rights, BBC excellent role model. I just found it fascinating. Looks like a bit of lipstick on this picture to me, Mike, so heavily posed. I couldn't resist thinking it reminded me of somebody, but I don't really want to make any form of humour about this one. I think this is despicable publicity by the BBC, and this is the bit that really got me. She says, as she kills people, I would try and not think of them as people. So we've got a woman who should be nurturing, bringing life into existence, is now a killer. BBC loves her because this is heading for the BBC role model. And I think the BBC's up to two things here. One, it's saying to presumably younger women, you need to become like Tiger Bowman and murder people while you try and pretend they're not real people. That's really what you should be doing. But of course, the BBC's secondary objective is to break down Kurdish and Syrian society, that it can be transformed into the BBC society of EastEnders, or as we've identified on many occasions, BBC Media Action's Kazakhstan Crossroads, where the BBC said we will introduce a new society. And this is the journalist, the BBC journalist, Emma Vardy. I personally think this is some of the most disgusting BBC stuff I have seen to date. And if you feel the same, perhaps you get in touch with this lady and just say to her that we don't really think it's worthwhile. I'll end with just that this is the main part of the BBC article. She tells BBC's Emma Vardy it's not just a battle against the extremist group, but a longer struggle for women's rights in which you kill. Brilliant.
We'll leave it there.
I think so. Patrick, if you've got any closing remarks, please do.
No, not just that, that BBC piece is probably more aligned, in my estimation, with promoting, helping to promote Kurdish autonomy in the region, or to this concept of a breakaway Kurdish state. So this is in line with partitioning Syria. I'm not going to read anything more into the narrative, but I think that overall, that's probably the function of that production.
Yeah, excellent. And Mark, if you've got any closing remarks as well.
Yeah, that's part of the cultural Marxism, this idea that women would leave their traditional roles. It's kind of like dismantling the nation state. You also have to dismantle the family organic unit within the nation state. as part of this postmodernist internationalist order that the Bilderberg Group, among many networking groups, wants to bring upon the world. This is part and parcel of cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School, and these subcultural things that kind of go under the radar, that go hand in hand with the internationalist establishment. I'm not surprised to see this. The same thing's happening in the United States, and it's going to lead to nothing but misery and hardship.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Well, to end on a positive note, I think we're starting to see panic and chaos in the political scene. I think a lot of that has come about because the political parties are certainly understanding that the public are waking up, and waking up some subjects very quickly. That is due to the good work of a great many people who are challenging the complete failure of the mainstream media. So keep doing whatever you're doing out there. But finally, I'd also like to say that I understand that Chief Constable of Wiltshire, Mike Veal, has been delighted at the support that he's been receiving from the public. I think he's used the word humbled in his thanks and his commentary on the fact that he's gone from being a policeman under a great deal of pressure for doing his job in investigating Edward Heath and child abuse to a policeman who's now started to receive some really good support from the public. So if you haven't emailed him, written or telephoned to thank him for what he's trying to do, which is to bring child abusers to justice, you might like to do that. That's it, I think. Thanks very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.